The lights are on red. We're away.
Welcome to MotoGPOD, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. My name is Jim Race. Today is November 20th. This is episode number 204, and I'm here with Jules Cisek, and we're just kind of hanging out. How you doing, Jules?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm still reeling from the fact that we're in off-season, but kind of dealing with it.
Yeah, it is weird, and we're kind of, you know, like, moving back and forth and trying to follow the breadcrumbs of what is left. But it seems like, you know, there's still a fair amount of things going on, and, you know, trying to keep on top of it is, it's sort of like trailing a bear that's long gone into the woods, and you're just trying to find out where it is. But, you know, we still had some fun.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, we got a few emails this weekend too.
Yeah, we did. Gordon Howell from Pole Position wrote in about the event in Valencia. They were doing a event for Pole Position on Friday, where Eugene Laverty was actually speaking, and they raised €8,500. So that's really, really awesome. So congratulations to Gordon and his team, and big thanks, of course, to Eugene. So thanks for writing in, Gordon.
So a translation from, OMJ, Old Man Jenkins, at rideon2.com, resident curmudgeon still, translated a, GP1 article, and thanks for that. And it was Danny talking about the aliens. He says, really, I've seen when Rossi understands that on a given Sunday, he must not be beaten. At Barcelona, it was clear to see that he had to win at all costs. And, you know, Jules, we saw that. I mean, that was perhaps one of the most insane races of the year. He knows which moments are key. Other Sundays, you see him arrive second, but there are times when he knows perfectly that he must not lose. Lorenzo is now a more consistent rider, very aggressive, but he's learned to calm himself in moments when it is not so clear. Before, he was always aggressive and he made more mistakes. In Stoner, I haven't seen anything new. He's a simple rider. What he shows, what he sees, you don't hide anything.
I love that last bit, especially the what he shows, what you see, and he doesn't hide anything. It's so true. It's like that's Stoner to a T. It's such an interesting thing to have Danny like analyze these guys as this. So in just a few sentences, because he really nails it.
Yeah, he does. And frankly, I mean, the what you see is what you get thing is what I personally have always been saying all along about Stoner, and everybody's been going, well, you know, there's more mysteries behind the curtain. And I don't think there's a curtain. Yeah, I thought he digested it and boiled it down really well, and that was cool. And, you know, I'd like to see more of that kind of straight talk. You know, it didn't seem like that was something that was run through the pooch filter. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And so, very cool. Very cool. Later on, we're gonna have a great interview you did, but, we've got a couple other things to talk about. And carry on with that, if you will.
There was this incredibly great, two-part interview that, David Emmett at, Moto Matters did with, Peter Clifford, who ran a WCM team effort for about four seasons, I think they were running.
Yeah. Yeah. And it went through a really kind of three seasons, I think. And it went through a really weird metamorphosis through the entire period.
Right. Right. Yeah. And it's really great, interview. And you definitely will. We have links to it in the show notes. So definitely follow that, read the whole thing. But what really kind of jumped out at me was something that interesting that Peter said about controlling, kind of like how far you can push the bikes if they were going to go back to the bigger motors, you know, the 1,000cc, even kind of production based stuff, whatever, which is lower the number of gears.
Yeah. And, you know, that's been talked about. And my own personal thought is, I would rather just give the teams more fuel. I think that would save everybody more money instead of, you know, redrawing the map. But
here's the thing is like hippie alert. I do have to say that that's one thing that I actually really like is the fuel the fuel limits going down year by year, because it does force, you know, the engineers to think about more efficient ways of burning the stuff.
No, I mean, dude, it's racing, and we're not. This is
I know, but that's, they have plenty of fuel to be racing with. But I'm just saying that, like, that technology has real world implications, I'd like to see, you know, in the future, I'd like to see electric bike racing become much, much more than just a, you know, a goofy exhibition at the Isle of Man.
Okay, so I'm going to ask you a question, and you need to answer this honestly.
Yeah.
When you are at the track and you're doing a track day, and you're going down the front straight, do you not, you know, kind of want to open your throttle all the way?
Absolutely. But but if somebody gave me a motor that gave me the same amount of power and used less fuel, hello.
Okay, well, you know, okay. So this is, ladies and gentlemen, everybody that's listening, this is the same guy that was like railing against the Spectire rule last year, and now he wants green bikes. I'm going to kill him. So this will be my last show. Yeah.
Okay, apples and oranges, dude. Apples and oranges.
I guess so. Yeah, we can agree to disagree. You know what? I don't think there's a place for it. And whatever. I mean, that's fine. But I think that you know, we can do a lot with what we have, and I think that we should continue to do so. And I don't think that we have to, you know, like, take that particular piece out of the pie. I think that the bikes still need to have, and Jules, seriously, take an 800, right? That's already fully developed. And one of the huge limitations right now, in fact, you saw it with the Ducati strategy, right? That we had at the last race, where they were trying to conserve fuel. Give them fuel. Right? Give them enough fuel so they don't have to like deal with that kind of bullshit. And it's an issue that's taken away. They can come out of corners faster. They can take away some of the electronics because they can actually rip up the track. And I think it's better. And we're not talking a ton, Jules. We're talking like, you know, 3 or 4 gallons for a race.
Yeah. I'm not talking about wasting fuel during racing.
Yeah.
I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the fact that technology that gets developed in order to be have more efficient engines gets eventually to every single vehicle on the planet. And like, I'm not being like this crazy environmentalist. I think that it's just it's a smart thing to do. It's like, why not have these kinds of limits? You know, I understand racing itself is a minute percentage of, it has no real environmental impact, you know? So that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the fact that there's technology that gets developed in the right direction. That's all.
True. You know, you and I thought we were going to have a really short cast tonight, but we could probably go on about this forever. So I'm going to move on. Can you move on?
Oh yeah.
Okay. Cause I could keep going. Trust me. What else do we have? We had, and you know what, let's just put that in the bag of the bigger motors, less gears theory for later, because I think if there may be more stuff that comes down the pike on it. So,
well, I was really interested in hearing what, cause you said that it's good in theory, but, and then we kind of got on a tangent. So what were you going to say?
Okay. So what I was going to say is that you'd be talking about a complete massive motor redesign, which would cost every company a shitload of money, because they would be developing motors to provide way more torque across a much wider power band, because that's exactly what you have to do.
Yep.
For 5 gears, for example. And
by the way, just as a you know, a little fine text in this, I'm not saying that I agree with this. I'm just saying that it was very interesting. I've never heard that particular angle.
Yeah, I'm just thinking. You know, I'm just thinking. Any rule changes, every rule change, regardless if it has to do with engines or any engineering specifications, is going to cost a company money, or will make a company spend money to work their way around it. Well, I think that one is a little bit too extreme.
Okay, I totally buy that. I totally agree. I mean, frankly, I'm even thinking that they should just stick with the 800 formula because they've already spent all the money. They're already in there. I mean, I really don't think they're going to save money by going back to 990s. The spec engine is kind of a strange thing because they're now talking that like maybe satellite teams will get spec engines, and the factory teams can still have a slightly smaller capacity, but they get to do whatever they want. It's almost like, why not just have, like, you know, cars versus bikes or something eventually, right?
Yeah,
they're gonna be so diverse at that point that the racing could be crazy, not in a good way.
Yeah, no, I mean, and you know that, and I agree, I totally agree too. And so, I think that we should, and it goes back to the point that I was making before, before you jumped on me for your hippie stuff.
Dude, I didn't jump on you. What the hell?
I'm giving you shit. Is that if we had the 800s with more gas, it wouldn't be an issue because they would have everything that they wanted. They'd have a bike with the power. They could dial down the electronics, and they wouldn't have all the stuff that people are complaining about now, you know, like non-close races, no sliding, all of that. So,
well, interesting that you should say that, because one of the most interesting insights that we get from the gentleman we're about to hear in a few minutes is that he actually thinks that we were going to get to the less sliding anyway, because it's just sliding is just not fast. That's, you know,
and I agree, and frankly, he's one of the masters of both sliding and non-sliding.
Yeah.
So, you guys are going to, excuse me, you guys are going to dig this. It's going to be fun. Stepping forward, let's move on, sir.
Yes.
The MotoGP awards ceremony, and specifically the after the flag video, this week just kicked all sorts of butt.
Yeah. It was really great.
It was fun. It was funny. It has some great appearances by a whole bunch of people. Watching Gavin Emmett and Matt Roberts do battle, per se, was killer. And we'll link to that. And if you haven't watched it, please do. You'll really appreciate it. It'll kind of give you a little bit of the taste of the end of the season, because and there were some really special things that were done in it. So make sure you listen to it and watch it.
Yeah. Yeah. We won't give any too much away, but it's definitely worth watching. So we have a YouTube link, and you should also go to the MotoGP.com website and click on the after the flag button. And if you have iTunes, you can then subscribe to the show. It doesn't come out that often, but when it does, it'll automatically get it on your iTunes and iPod, whatever you might be using. So
yeah, and you know, it's a good reminder. And both you and I have kind of bitched over the years about, you know, the quality of MotoGP.com website for watching the races. But frankly, this year it was really good, wasn't it?
It was. Although at Valencia they were experimenting with some new stuff, and the qualifying was very difficult to watch. A lot of people were complaining that they couldn't get in, or we were even getting blackouts during the races.
Yeah, but you know, in the end, I mean, considering what we used to experience, like
like no race at all for 3 days,
days of yore. Yeah. I think they're doing a fine job, and I think that, frankly, they should give MotoGPOD.com several free accounts. Don't you?
Oh yeah, that's a great idea, Gavin. You listen, right? All right.
So, what's up? We got a little bit of news.
Well, before we get to the news, I wanted to kind of throw up an idea. Let's see how this goes. But you know, they had the awards ceremony for MotoGP, so we decided kind of to do something interesting, which is in Julian Ryder's reviews for every year, he has the writers rate each other. They kind of do this like.
I think the term that you're looking for is peer review.
Yeah, it's a peer review. Exactly. It's a peer review. Now, obviously, we're not peers to these guys. So what we were thinking about doing is to have you guys, the listeners, send in 15 riders from MotoGP. You can throw in 250 riders and 125 riders in there as well if you want.
Old.
And rate, basically rank them from first to 15th. And then what we'll do is we'll combine all of the results into a spreadsheet and we'll see what the MotoGP OD audience thinks, basically. And so what we'll do is we set up a special email address. It's just the number of this episode, which is 204@MotoGPOD.com. So just send in your 15 riders in order that you think that they deserve to be in. And we'll plug it into a spreadsheet. We'll tally all the points up, and we'll run this for like 2 weeks. So there's plenty of time for everybody to send in their votes, and we'll see what people think. I think it'll be really fun.
I think it'll be cool, and I expect at least one or two people to be on it. Toot sweet,
right?
But we have some very dedicated listeners that like. And we totally appreciate it that talk to us in email all the time. And seriously, we're not kidding. When we say that we respond to email, guys and girls, send it in. We're happy to respond. It's fun. We appreciate it. Keep it up. So anyway.
Yeah, it might take a few days sometimes, but yeah, you'll get a response.
Yeah. And not even really a cranky one unless you're cranky yourself in the first place.
And remember, you can also email us through the contact form on the website,
which is really the best way to do it. And on that note, Jules, I need to kind of all apologize for us. We're having some issues with this website, so that if you guys have problems downloading an episode or something, feel free to let us know. Send us an email through the contact website. You can send it to popmonkey@motogpod.com. You can send it to race@motogpod.com. And we'll let you know an alternative way. But if something's happening, we're trying to get it taken care of. But
it's actually been taken care of now, this particular issue. And I now have a little recipe of how to deal with it in the future. But we have had issues where the show was not available from the website. But usually it's available from via iTunes. So, you know.
Yeah, or Feedburner or wherever else. So, but I mean, for those of you that have had troubles, you know, we just want to let you know we're on it. We know. Next, there is a little bit of news. So we kind of an interesting piece because we thought it was going to fade away. Nico Canepa got picked up by Scott for their Moto2 squad, which is way cool. You know, I forget which chassis they plan on running, but I want to say it's one of the FTR bikes, but I'm not quite positive. But it should be pretty cool, and you know, good for him. You know, we were saying last week,
is it NCR?
It might be. I'm not positive, and that will fit perfectly, will it not, into our Moto2 show?
Yeah, exactly.
Not a whole lot of words out of World Superbike Land, World Supersport.
They're all on vacation now. They're all, you know.
They really are, and they're kicked back. In fact, they're being quiet all over the place. I did a really cool interview today with Dave Williams, Dave Moss, and a couple of guys from OTT, who a lot of you people pay attention to, and we'll get that together. So I just want to say thanks to them for letting us do that. And then you're going to be at the International Motorcycle Show this weekend, aren't you?
Yeah, we have Riders for Health again is doing a booth. We're going to be there Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And Adam Silver is probably going to be there the whole weekend because he's just crazy dedicated. He's basically like the Northern California representative for Riders for Health. And I'm going to help him out on Saturday. So if you're in the Bay Area in San Francisco, Stop by Riders for Health on Saturday. Actually, stop by any day because Adam Silver will be going climbing the walls. And just let's have a little chat.
Yeah, frankly, Adam is a hoot, and well worth going by and just having a chat. The guy's great, and many thanks to him and Riders for Health for doing all that they do, and seriously worthy cause. So, awesome. That'll be fun. I've worked the motorcycle show, man, and it can be kind of brutal. Long hours, sometimes it's kind of quiet, but you'll have a blast. Have you worked the IMS before?
Not the IMS. I mean, I've done Riders for Health at like La Ducati Day, and I it doesn't make much of a difference to me because it's like, I'm going to be hanging around the booth for, 8 hours.
And frankly, you'll have somebody to chat with anyway, so you'll have a great time. What else? We got a couple of bits that we put up, links for, of course, for the Peter Clifford interview.
Yep.
We've got the After the Flag one, so you folks can watch that. And it's interesting about the Clifford interview because that was from way back in what was it, June or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I read it. And, David's kind of like me, he's like, keeps these things in the bag and it's nice to have something handy, if you need to pull it out. But I think one of the fascinating things from that interview that kind of caught my ear and attention was the stuff about Blatta, and what they had, were trying to bring forward to the table and how that didn't succeed. So folks, you have to follow that, read it. It's very, very interesting. And it was really a nice piece on his part.
It is. Great piece. All right. So let's just jump into the main event of the evening, which is we've got Keith Code from Superbike, California Superbike Schools. He recently released a DVD version of his Twist of the Wrist 2 book. I've watched the DVD. It's excellent. And we'll talk about it a little bit with Keith. And then Keith gives some amazing insights about MotoGP riders, what makes these champions. It's a fascinating, fascinating interview. He's a really cool guy, so you're going to really enjoy. Plus, there's a little bit of interesting news there that he mentions towards the end, which is that that California Superbike School is no longer going to be running with Kawasaki. They are now going to be running with the S1000RR from BMW.
Whoa.
Nice. Yeah, which is huge. I mean, because they've been with Kawasaki for 30 years, they've been with 600s, basically running 600s, and now they're going to be on a leader bike. Keith is extremely impressed with the bike. They're changing colors. I mean,
yeah, no,
the weirdest thing, I think.
The first thing I thought of was like, there's a whole bunch of neon green paint that I can pick up on the sly.
So the interesting thing will be, will he build the slide bike and the no bullshit bike in off the BMW? Well, I forgot to ask him that. But anyway, so here you go. Here's Keith Code, and enjoy.
All right, this is Jules Cisek from MotoGPOD, and I'm on the phone with Keith Code of the California Superbike School and author of Twist of the Wrist. There are 3 volumes of those. You've written some other books as well, and most recently you've produced a DVD for Twist 2.
Yeah, Jules, we finally finished it after 14 months of editing, and it's being received really, really well, and which is great and hugely gratifying for me for all the thousands of hours and 4.5 years that I put into it. So it was great to get that one out there. And I mean, the Twist of the Wrist Volume 2 book came out in 1994, I think. So, 15 years is a long time, but it was kind of okay because we had 15 years of students and coaching and using the material and so on, so that we really knew exactly how it worked and what people were having problems with. So it was good for that. The time, was well spent and kind of in research.
And Twist Volume 2 is like probably the most important of the twist books, because it's for anybody who rides sport bikes, because twist one was very basic and two is where you really kind of turned on the technology, as you call it. And but it was always like, I read the book, you know, maybe 10, 11 years ago, and you know, and then I just watched the DVD maybe a week ago, and the DVD really gave me a lot of aha moments. But before we get too far into that, I just want to make sure people who don't really, who might not know, they might have heard of your school, they might have heard of the books, they probably don't realize, there's maybe some people that don't realize, like, you've also coached a lot of very successful racers. So I'm just going to go through this quick list. Like, I know this is not even everybody, but like Wayne Rainey, Eddie Lawson worked with you, Bubba Schobert, Doug Chandler, Fred Merkel, Scott Russell, Jake Zemke, Chuck Graves, both the Bostroms, Tommy Hayden, John Kaczynski, Leon Camier recently. I believe your UK branch worked with Thomas Luthi, who was the 125 CC champion.
Yeah.
And Peter Lentz, who's been on our show. He's a good friend of the show. So.
Sure. Yeah, we've been working with him for 4 years.
Yeah, he's a great kid.
Peter's a great, great kid, great rider. We're looking forward to him getting back on the bike.
Yep. Okay, so, so I was just saying, like, the DVD really kind of, first of all, I love the fact that you have Julian Ryder on there. what a great
Julian
voice.
Great. Yeah, perfect. He was perfect. I was going to narrate it like I did the first one, the first DVD that followed the first Twist of the Wrist book, but... You know, I just got tired of listening to my own voice, Jules. This is really what happened. I cannot hear myself one more time say these things. And then Julian and I had announced some World Superbike stuff in England when I go over there and have been going over there for about 14 years, you know, with establishing our school over there and getting an idea of it, moving along on it and so on. So I'd go over there and... Julian and I had done some announcing together, and we really got along really well. And went, you know, Julian's voice. That's it. That's going to cover it. Good. And it just worked out perfect. You're right.
He could probably read the ingredients off like a, you know, of a box of Cheerios and make it sound really exciting. You know?
Right. He could turn it into GP. Right.
Yeah.
You're right. Absolutely. Yeah. He was a. Really, a quality that the DVD needed. Somebody else saying those things, and you know he's trained at it. He's a pro, and that's you know the rest of the film is pro. We shot it on high def. We really lucked out when we were shooting the thing because there was huge strikes in Hollywood, and there were all these really super talented people out. You know, kind of scratching around looking for work.
Oh, that's right. So, that's right.
Yeah, that was last year, last June, and so we got fantastic quality of highly professional people, which was great. And you know, luckily for us, we got them at a really good price too, and they wanted to work. So one of the really cool things about it was a lot of the people who were on the shoot had never ridden a motorcycle before, but everybody at the end of the shoot, you know, there are a couple dozen people who were on it, the girls, the guys who had never ridden there, everybody was interested in riding after they saw what we were doing and what was actually happening. And, you know, that you really could learn how to ride a motorcycle. And it obviously looked really fun.
Yeah, that's very cool. So you actually had a couple converts too.
Oh, yeah.
Nice.
It was really, really good.
Very nice. The track that you used, where was that shot?
We shot it at all three Willow Springs tracks, the Horse Thief Mile, it's called, and then the Streets of Willow Springs, and also the Road Course, the regular big Willow Springs track.
Okay, yeah, I recognize that one. I'm not that familiar with Willows, so mm-hmm. Streets of Willows, so.
Right, we used all the three of those tracks for all the track shots, and then we used Angeles Crest Highway, Angeles Forest Highway, and a couple of the other canyons around the LA area up in the mountains to shoot the street and canyon stuff, which was really, really great. And it was, you know, again, it was a totally pro shoot. We had the California Highway Patrol guys blocking the road off so we could ride fast and do whatever we needed to do on the roads. And that made it really cool. You know, we didn't go up there and just steal the shots. We were able to get out there with a full crew, you know, with all the good cameras and all the HD equipment. So that made it really, really good too. It was cutting the 65 hours of high def down into 2 hours, which was the interesting part.
Man, yeah, that must have been a job. Were you involved in the editing of that?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the director did a preliminary edit especially on the scenes where there were people interacting with one another. You know, the basic, you know, as
like
you
the dialogue
saw,
stuff.
Yeah, the two guys who kind of carry the story along, being new writers, and you know, they come up with little problems, and the little problems that they have, of course, are big problems in a lot of ways. And once again, you know, our experience that we've had over the, well, really 125,000 students through the school, and you know, the 10.5 million track miles we've done during the last 30 years gave me a really good sense of, you know, what problems they really do run into, because we have just seen it over and over again. So they kind of carry the story forward. They have a problem, and then we go into a technical description of what's right, what's wrong, you know, what's it look like when it's done right, what's it look like when it's done wrong, and then, you know, the comparison shots between techniques. In that I think was really an important element to add in there, because people have done it wrong plenty of times. Maybe they lucked out and got it right, but until they see it, then it doesn't really always hit home. And that was the intention that I wrote the script with, and I think we got it.
Yeah, I was just going to say earlier that the book has great diagrams in it, and obviously it gets much more into a lot of the techniques, but to see it in motion really was like, ah, yeah, I get it, you know, and you know, there's little overlays, and yeah, I kind of started watching it and was thinking, oh man, this could be like an infomercial type DVD, and almost immediately I realized, no, this is I'm actually going to learn something. And you know, I actually suffer from so many of these SRs myself some of them I still don't have no idea how I'm ever going to get over the, you know, roll off when I panic. I mean, that's like my number one issue when I ride.
Sure. Yeah, and that's why it was important to include, you know, the survival reactions, just as they're laid out in the Twist of the Wrist Volume 2 book, because, again, it's just all that experience that we've had with so many people. And you know, at 104 tracks around the world in 20 countries. And, you know, it just doesn't make any difference whether you ride on the right side of the road or the left side of the road in Australia or England or Germany, France, England, you know, wherever. It doesn't make any difference. It's the same problems grip riders, and they battle with the same fundamentals. And if those fundamentals aren't there, then, you know, reaching for the next cool technique, it doesn't solve anything. Just like any technology, any technical pursuit of any kind, you know, if you don't know what the basics are, then you continue to trip on those, and that's really what I tried to seem successfully did bring through in that DVD, that these are the things. If you don't know these things, you will continue to have trouble with your writing. They will come back to haunt you, and forever. So.
Yeah.
To that degree, I think it was really successful in giving writers that reality point of, oh yeah, that's what it is, and really happy that it came out that way.
Yeah. So, how do you unlearn all these survival instincts, you know, that we all have, obviously?
Coaching. You have to be coached through them. You know, it would be like diving or, I mean, even golf, anything really, because riders have a tendency to do what feels right. And what feels right is often 180 degrees off what is right with the bike, for the corner, for the riding situation, right? So when we just go by feel alone, then we can only feel so much. We can only get so far on feel unless, you know, you're one of those lucky people that start riding at 3 or 4 years old and just never stopped and never had a real job. You just did that only. You know, those guys don't always succeed to the top of the game. So it can't just be on feel alone. There's got to be some analytical awareness. There has to be some understanding. And the coaching part of it pushes you through those things. Again, you know, if you're learning how to dive, you want to do what feels right, and most often that is colored by your own personal survival instincts. You know, I don't want to get hurt. So to actually move through those things, you have to bring a rider along, a small step at a time, so that they see it really gets better when you do it right. And once you got that hook set, then you can take a rider anywhere they want to go.
And then you have to practice, so it kind of becomes innate.
Hopefully, yes, for sure. Well, you know, yes and no. I mean, you can still be a terrific rider and still, you know, be focused on what you need to do to make it right. You can go an awfully long way on that alone. You know, whether a rider who, let's say, you know, is coming back into the sport and buying a motorcycle at 30, 35, 40 years old, you know, are they going to get to the point where it's just so natural that it would be like they started when they were, you know, 5 or 6 years old? And the answer is, yes, I've seen it happen. No, but can they get to the point where it's completely satisfying? And the answer to that is absolutely yes. That can and does happen on a daily basis at the Superbike School for sure. Beautiful to see it happen. And this is, I got the best job in the world. There is no job better than my job. You can't get comments like we get at the end of the school day from people, you know, unless you walk by with your little magic wand and say, you know, you're going to live forever, you're going to be rich, you're going to be beautiful, you're always going to have great food, the best cars, live in the grooviest houses. You know, it's that kind of turnaround, which is fantastic.
Yeah, I just want to get my lap times down.
Yeah, I just want to get my lap times down. Right. Well, there you go. Getting lap times down is a goal. It's getting their knee down, getting their lap times down. All these things come from, you know, really having some fundamentals under your belt so that you have a foundation to build on. And if that foundation isn't there, then you can't build on it. It's
right.
It's not possible.
Right.
Yeah.
We saw an amazing thing happen this year in the World Superbikes with Ben Spies, you know, going to, you know, all new circuits and very methodically kind of approaching the circuits and learning them. And, you know, he may not be the fastest guy in the first couple of practice sessions, but by the time we went to qualifying, you know, he was just blowing everybody else away. How does somebody approach, maybe not even a new circuit, but like riding a new motorcycle, riding a new circuit, if they already have all these, you know, for me, for example, I was riding for 10 years before I even read one of your books.
Mm-hmm.
And then it just felt like I was constantly struggling against the things that I've already learned. And, you know, how do you approach something like that?
Well, you know, one of the things that that happens is, first of all, there aren't an infinite number of different kinds of corners out there. You know, while the surface and so on can be a little different, a little grippier, a little slippery, or whatever it is, getting what's the most basic part of a corner? The most basic part of a corner is what the radius of the turn is. You know, that's the main thing you have to deal with in order to find a line through a corner. You have to know what the corner looks like. And a guy like Ben Spies is clearly not saddled with the usual unfortunate survival instincts of most people. You know, he's got very, very good visual skills, and I think that's one of the things that sets him apart. That's one of the things that allowed him to, you know, get a really, really solid top 10 finish at Valencia, you know, just this week ago. He learned circuits really well. He's able to relate the what he's doing. You know, he's not going out there and following, you know, Stoner around, or Rossi, or Lorenzo, or Pedrosa, or those guys. He's not following them around. He's out there and he's learning it on his own. And I think that Ben has got that kind of enthusiasm for, you know, the really innate enthusiasm and the visual skills to back it up to be able to do that. And again, it's, you know, there aren't an infinite number of kinds of corners out there. But I heard a great comment from him recently, which was learning tracks that are super technical, like places like Sears Point, you know, just oodles and oodles of corners in 2.5 miles, you know, it's not this big spread out kind of tracks like Valencia and many of the other tracks in Europe. So being able to operate on those really, really technical tracks gives you a little bit more freedom, you know, a little bit more time, a little bit more choices, and it's slightly easier to orient yourself visually because, you know, without the visual orientation, without being able to, you know, really see what you're dealing with, then, you know, you can't do what he was doing. It's not possible. It hasn't got anything to do with how he works the bike, where he sits on the bike, how fast the bike is, how good the tires are, or anything. It is all about his visual skills, and you know, that's the key. That's his strongest suit at this time.
Yeah, you're talking about like just general awareness, not just braking markers or anything like that, but just awareness of where he is on the track exactly, and you know, where's the next corner going to be, and how is he going to approach it. He's just visualizing the entire thing. I mean, you know, I think we all try that, but you know, some people are much better at it than others.
Well, humans orient themselves with reference points, and those who do it either analytically and, you know exactly where they turn the bike, know exactly where they brake the bike, know exactly where they want to apex the bike, and can sit and talk to you about it is one variety of rider. Then you got other guys, you know, like Colin, and you know, he says when he's on the track, he knows everything, and you know, it was another comment I heard that he made. But if once he gets off the bike, you know, he wouldn't be able to tell you anything about it. And you know, it's very interesting as a coach to sit down with somebody like that and find the right questions to ask so that you can actually get an answer to them, because there is an answer in there. But you know, in a lot of cases, I was just thinking about it tonight. Actually, there are a lot of guys out there who, if you start talking to them about their riding, they don't want to talk about it because they're almost afraid that, you know, their mojo is going to break. They don't quite know how they do what they do, and it's like they just feel like it could abandon them if they even start looking at it. And that's, well, that's just the way some guys are. That's just the way some guys are, and there are a few out there, very few actually, that are very successful with it. But you know, I think the guys who get there, who stick, who stay, who win the championships, continue to win the championships, you know, there's that little spark of analytical awareness. There's a little spark of understanding. There's that slightly extra, almost extra sensory perception of, you know, being able to do the actions while they're out there, and also have a really, really solid awareness of what they're doing while they're doing it. And that I think is a, you know, it's kind of broad in general, but there's a definite cut in there from the very finest riders to the, you know, second tier guys.
Yeah, I actually really wanted to ask you, like, what you thought was the you know, because there's a lot of really fantastic riders out there who can do great laps on their own, but then you throw in the element of actually racing against somebody, and yeah, now they have to adjust on the fly, kind of their game plan. It's not just about hitting markers and about you know knocking those laps up one by one, but also making that adjustment to make a change, to break a little later, or change the length of the corner so they can get on the gas a little earlier and surprise the other guy. You know.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, the guy's baseline thing is, you know, you know, well, actually sort of like it is like a kind of a baseline in music. You know, you get the doom, 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 and pretty much everything's going to key off of that. You know, that's the guy who's setting the heartbeat of the thing. And the riders who are really, really successful, you know, they've got that baseline. They've got a rhythm. They can always go to it, and they're sure of it. They're positive that they can drop back to that baseline and everything's going to be okay. You know, maybe they're not going to win that race, but they've always got that baseline. But without that baseline, you can't take that small leap forward. You can't see if you can knock off a couple more hundredths in this corner or that corner. You know, it becomes a kind of a, you can almost see a rider hunting for, you know, for the magic formula to get them around that corner a little bit better. You know, you see, in MotoGP especially, you can see very, very small changes. You know, those guys are accurate with their riding for sure. But when you start to see small changes, you know, slightly different apex, a slightly different turn-in point from somebody who's on who's got a factory ride, then what you're looking at is that they've kind of lost their confidence in their rhythm, their baseline. They've lost their baseline, and you see this kind of slightly ragged hunting that they're doing with the bike, and that's what I see when I watch Nicky. I see him hunting a little bit. It's like the baseline's just—it's not there. It's not solid enough. You know, it's not to say he's not a great rider or anything. That's not it. It's that the baseline isn't as strong as it needs to be. And so when he gets to the point where he wants to make that leap, you know, catch that guy or hang in there, you know, up front, then there, you watch it and you see these slightly altered things going on, slightly different than the time before, and. You know, it's not desperation, but it is a hunting thing with trying to find the, you know, solution to something.
Do you think he is looking for the right kind of feeling where he feels he finally nails it, or is he maybe just a little bit inaccurate?
No, he's not inaccurate. That's not it. He can be very, very accurate, but at his accuracy level, it's just a 0.5% below where he needs to be. And that's all it is, 0.5%. It isn't 5% or 10%. It's 0.5%. And if you look at lap times, you'll see 0.5% is all it's all that's needed, maybe 0.75%, but it's no more than one.
Yeah, it's actually amazing seeing when they actually have clear tracks, when Pedrosa or Stoner get away up front, and they have clear track, how incredibly accurate their lap times are lap to lap.
Yes, for sure. An amazing consistency, you know. Yeah, when Danny pulls his game together, as we have seen a few times over the last couple of years, he's just gone.
He's
gone.
Know,
he's in his own universe. He's in his own world. And when you watch him in that mode, like at Laguna Seca, you know, he was just clicking them off, picking them up and laying them down. It was beautiful, you know. He wasn't hunting for anything. He was 100% positive of what his game plan was. His baseline, his rhythm was so totally solid. And, you know, whether he could have gone any better than that, I don't know. But it was like he clicked into that groove, and it was beautiful. It was a beautiful thing to watch. It was nice to watch Rossi, you know, push a little bit and see if he could find a little time here and there too. But you know, we know that Rossi's, you know, his baseline, that underlying, you know, foundation rhythm that he's got is, you know, super, super strong. And Stoner's is too. He's the guy who is willing to, his baseline is super strong, but he likes to push it. He likes to test it. And he's not hunting for some improvement. He just likes to push. He just likes to push his baseline. It's almost like there's no razor. There's no knife edge in there for that guy. He's got a really nice, big, broad plane to play on, and he's willing to take those chances. And the great thing about it is that he rarely crashes because of it. You know, he's still got some control over that, and that's a tough combination to beat.
Yeah, you know, I was halfway through the season. I was just—I think it was at Assen. I was watching him go through that final chicane at Assen, and just the whole bike completely shaking like crazy. And he just seems like it doesn't bother him at all.
He's got that groove. When he gets in that groove, he's just got a lot of prediction on what's going to happen, you know. And he's willing to make. To push it, he's willing to take chances.
He probably he's conquered a lot of those survival reactions.
For sure.
Most of us will never conquer, and he just completely just, you know. I mean, you watch those little when they have the onboard shots, and they show you the throttle and brake usage. He commits completely.
Yeah, you're right, and he's really short. That the bike is going to come through for him, and one of the great things is about Stoner is that his riding is a very, very light touch, because when you ride that loose, if you don't have a really light touch with the bike, if you don't have I mean, you know, a really, really solid relationship with it. I mean, a marriage that is just not going to go away, right? Where each of you can, you know, can say anything to the other person, you can do anything to the other person, and it's going to be forgiven. It's going to be taken in stride, you know. And that's the kind of relationship he has with the bike. It's a good solid connection without being overbearing, and that's what he's got. And you can tell that because as loose as he rides the bike, he would be losing the front end all the time, and he would be crashing far more than he does.
Yeah, yeah. I remember in the DVD you talk about like how, you know, it's very often you have to just let the bike kind of recover on its own because it's much better at it than a lot of riders are. And there's a really great illustrative moment. I don't remember what it was. It was like 2003. I think it was Alex Hoffman on the Kawasaki. And he fell off he was fighting the bike through a corner. He got onto a straight. I want to say it was a Mugello, but I'm not sure. And he was just, the bike was wobbling and he was fighting. You could see he was trying to regain control of it. And he ended up getting thrown off the bike like it was a Bronco. And then the bike just completely straightened out and went down the straightaway. You know,
exactly.
The moment he's, you know, there was no more fighting input from the rider, everything just came together again.
I've seen it a dozen times in racing. The instant the rider is ejected or his hands come off the bars, the bike has a tendency to straighten up. And, you know, that whole aspect of connecting to the motorcycle is something we've, you know, I've been working on developing for a really long time. And in the second Twist of the Wrist book, finally I started to see that rider positioning on the motorcycle was important. And it really wasn't anything that was talked about before that. You know, you'd have McDoohan talking about weighting the outside peg for traction or something like that. But it really wasn't, you know, well, what is right body positioning on the motorcycle? What's really good and what's bad? What actually works and what doesn't work? And, you know, through these last 15 years, you know, at the Superbike School, we've come up with, okay, there are actually 38 individual points that go towards helping or hurting, if they're not right, the rider and his body positioning on the motorcycle. And of course, we're talking specifically about sport bike and track riding and racing, but most of them even apply to street riders and, you know, just riding around in canyon roads enthusiastically. So it's that is something that is also if you take 10 or 15 years ago and compare what the riders look like on the motorcycles, it's become far more homogenized now because riders are actually doing what works. They're not just sitting on the bike in a way that feels right. They are riding the bike and using the, you know, quote, hang off position, unquote, correctly. And it's, except for a couple of guys like Tony Elias.
It's so funny because you talk a lot about the body position. And as I was watching the DVD, I was thinking, not Tony Elias, because he actually hangs his butt below the pegs.
Right. But you realize, just look at the other 6-17 guys out there and you see them, they're not doing that.
No, it's true. It's true. In fact, the little half-cheek comment that you make on there, it's totally true. You know, they really just, you know, they might stick their knee out, but they're not just throwing themselves over like he does.
No, it doesn't really work. But if you were to, you know, go up to Elias and say, well, you know, you really need to fix this, and he's going to tell you that this is what feels right, and that's the way he's going to do it. And it's highly unlikely that you'd be able to talk him out of it, even though, you know, you could sit down, you could make drawings, you could do demonstrations and so on and so forth, and say this is why that isn't good for your riding. And you still may not be able to talk him out of it. And I've run into, you know, world champions who have the same attitude, and they go, yeah, I know I do that, but I just can't stop doing it. And it's one of those things that you can't afford anymore. You can't afford to lose that few hundredths of a second, that type of thing. It's not the only thing, but that type of thing reduces as far as your ability to get through the corners efficiently and fast. It's just, you just can't afford it anymore. Doesn't mean that you couldn't have a few days of inspiration and ride well. It means that it's a tentative grasp on it, and it doesn't provide the rider for something to build on. You know, it can't go anywhere with it. Whereas you watch Pedrosa, you watch Lorenzo, you watch Rossi, you watch those guys, you watch them for the tail camera, and you see that they can move around on the bike a little bit through the corners. They actually can use their body position to big advantage through the middle and on the exits of the corners. Whereas Elias really, really can't do it. He's already got himself so stretched out on that thing and so cocked up on it that he has no place to go. He's like used it to its limit. But physics-wise, it's counter to the essential element that hanging off actually gives you. So he's fighting himself it for sure.
Long ago, the whole hanging off style was considered to be a way to steer the bike because you put so much extra, you basically changed the center of gravity on the bike. Is that really what's going on?
Well, if you put a lot of weight on the inside foot peg, you know, the bike will veer off course, but you can't make it turn. You can't get into a corner just on foot peg weight alone. And yeah, sure. I mean, it's the old myth that, you know, you put your knee on the tank and you tug the bike over. Well, it has no validity whatsoever. You cannot steer a motorcycle like that effectively. Pushing on the foot peg is another thing. It's just a myth. It's not how you steer a motorcycle. You have to push on the handlebars. No matter what the guy says, no matter who they are, you got to push on the handlebars to get the bike to turn, and to do it efficiently and to do it effectively, to get through through the corkscrew at Laguna Seca. And then you see these things. You see Rossi with his, well, he started off with his left foot coming off the foot peg after he's made it because downshifts. Then you see the right foot coming off, and you realize that there is absolutely no peg weighting going on here as far as, you know, helping to steer the bike. There's not zero.
Right.
That, and the weight of the leg out there could possibly have some sort of negligible effect on it. But whatever, it doesn't make any difference. It's simply that the peg weighting thing is just a load of crap.
What is going on with this leg hanging off thing? You must get that question a lot, don't you?
Well, I've heard the question before, and the answer is: look who started it, and then who in the world of racing is the king of mischief?
I like it.
And you come up with the same guy, yeah. Valentino Rossi, right? So I think he's stretching his leg once or twice, and then he figured that, you know, it was kind of stylish, but you know, there isn't anybody out there who's professing that this is, you know, the awesome, cool thing to do. And, you know, he's stated publicly that he doesn't even know whether it does anything himself.
Right, right, right. But riders are, it's funny because riders really do pick up that stuff from him, I think. It just trickles down because now, at Laguna Seca, I was hanging out at turn five during one of the practice sessions, and I would say at least half the riders were doing it. You know, they were letting that foot hang out, the left foot going into turn five.
Look, if Rossi published the schedule of when he woke up, when he ate, what he did, what he did during the day, I can assure you that there would be hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of racers who would take that thing and they would remold their lives to do it that way.
I think Lorenzo's doing that. I think Lorenzo's totally doing that.
Lorenzo is his own man. He is just totally his own man. You know, that he got, you know, involved in the foot off the foot peg thing is a completely different subject. But he is really his own man. He's a really neat guy. You know, he's got interest in what happens in the world. You know, aside from just racing, he's really quite a bright guy. He's a good artist as well. He's a little different than your run of the mill racer. While he's figured out a few times how to outsmart, you know, the world's greatest $500,000 traction control systems, in high side, he's still, you know, he was a brilliant, absolutely stunningly brilliant 250 racer, obviously, and he's brilliant on the MotoGP bikes too. You know, he's been able to pull his 250 experience along with him, which is what you have to do now. You know, maybe well, he didn't really get the chance to ride the 990s, which was maybe okay. Maybe okay, because, you know, the guys who have come from World Superbike, Spies accepted for sure. Well, you know, yeah, Bayless did well too one time, but they get, I think they just have a different orientation than what's needed right now. Right now you have to do everything really well. You have to get through the corners really fast, and you also have to figure out how to get these good drives off of them. And, you know, say back in the 70s when Kenny Roberts first went to Europe, you know, I mean, it wasn't that he had horrible, bad corner speed for sure, but what he had that those other guys didn't have was he knew how to get the drives off the corners, and that was what, you know, propelled him into world championships. And, you know, then it started to evolve a little bit later on, and Lawson was able to pull it together with his four world championships because he was able to get enough, a better blend of corner speed and drives off the corners than anybody else was, and he had enough, he had enough 250 savvy to be able to do that, you know, not having gone through the whole 250, 125, 250 progression like, you know, all the successful MotoGP guys have gone through so far. I mean, up to this point, maybe Spies will break the mold, don't know.
I always felt that, like, for example, Hopper, John Hopkins went directly into MotoGP class.
Yep.
And he kind of, you know, he had a couple of really good years, but he never really reached, I think, his full potential. And now it's probably too late.
Yeah, big mistake for him to have bypassed the, you know, really, really solid 125 or 250 experience. It's, well, traditionally, at least over the last decade or so, it's been the success formula. It's been the major success formula. I think maybe the last guy who wasn't successful on small bikes also was McDoohan. And he had a special quality about him too.
Right.
But past that point, it's been am I right about this, Jules?
I don't know.
for sure, Rossi and
yep.
Stoner spent enough time on the 125s and 250s to have a good. But absolutely, Pedrosa,
Lorenzo. I mean, yeah.
Adrian Caparossi, you know, then maybe Melandri and Caparossi aren't, you know, doing what they are. Melandri, anyhow, not doing what they had been doing a few years ago. But you know, they were for sure up there for a long, long time. And so it's to me the qualities that you have to develop on 125s and 250s are pretty essential. You know, whether they're mandatory is, we'll see. Maybe they are, maybe they're not. Currently, yes, they're what is the support for these guys, because it's because of visual skills. The visual skills are developed on the 125s and 250s.
Yeah,
because they're midget bikes to begin with, so. You know, your eyeballs are practically on the pavement when you're going through a corner. So your ability to grasp, use reference points, and develop your visual skills come from that. That's where they come from. To say that you can't do it otherwise, I wouldn't be able to say that. But to say that you have to have them developed really well in 125s and 250s is for sure.
I hear you. Did you enjoy this season? Were you following it closely?
Yeah, you know, we travel so much. We're on the road like 150 days a year. So sometimes, you know, we'd actually miss races and have to wait, you know, weeks to get home to watch them on our TiVo. So, but I did try to watch all the MotoGP races, and I actually did miss a couple of them. But it was an interesting season for sure, and it's really very interesting to watch the riders pull, as I said before, pull these two things together. The corner speed at which these things are, and with attendant lean angle as well, pull them those together with the amazing drives that they're getting off the corners on the 800s. And I see technique changes that are occurring with the riders that came in with from the 990 era and were actually fairly present in the first couple years of the 800, and now they're slowly moving off. And most of that is, look, you know, you don't make time on the brakes, really. In the end, you've got to make time on the gas. You know, I mean, it's an old saying, and it's really, really true. And what I see now is there's less and less of what we all call trail braking. The brake release is getting shorter and shorter. It's not being drawn out longer and longer, because it was pretty stylish there for a while, you know, to brake pretty much to the apex, but it's not happening anymore. And if you watch somebody who you think, oh, look, this guy could really succeed, like James Toseland, and you watch the difference between what he's doing and what Rossi's doing, what Pedrosa's doing, what Lorenzo's doing, the guys who are really, really, really hammering it out right now, and you'll see that he's still got a little bit of that. He's still got it, and you can't afford those 2 or 3 meters of not being back on the gas anymore. You can't give it away. It's not possible to be up there and give it away. And that's one of the things that James was dealing with right now. You know, he had a lot of attention on the brakes and how hard those guys were braking the bikes. But, you know, brakes, you don't make time on the brakes. You can catch somebody, but you don't necessarily make time on them.
This is probably the best explanation of JT's issues that I've heard. It's been kind of a mystery of, because he started off pretty strong last year. You know, he did. He seemed to be getting it, and it was kind of downhill for him.
Well, I don't know that it was downhill for him. I think he was kind of relying on the, you know, his previous experience pretty heavily. But you know, the bar also got raised too. So
he got left behind, is what you're saying.
He did get left behind. Yeah, he didn't really get any slower.
Right. I hear you.
But he got left behind, and that's one of the things that I see as a bit of a hangover that he's having to deal with right now, and it was one of the points that is keeping him, you know, where he is right now.
Well, he's going to superbikes. Hopefully, he'll be able to use his skills a little better there.
Yeah, and I think that once he gets over the disappointment, and I'm sure he's disappointed, it'd be hard not to be disappointed, but he's got to put it behind him for sure if he wants to continue going along with this. And James is a really good guy, and he's an excellent, excellent, excellent racer. There's no question about that. So, wish him well for sure. And I'm sorry it didn't work out.
Yeah.
I really am. You know, I had the chance to teach him at our schools, you know, man, what, got to be 10 years ago now, over in England. And when he came out to the Superbike school over there, and it would have been fun to see if I could help him out, but, you know, just didn't work out that way.
Hmm. How the UK school is, so you actually go over there every once in a while and lend a hand?
Yeah, sure, sort of lend a hand. Our crew over there is really, really solid. The three main branches are the UK branch, of course, here, and also in Australia. And now it's really great because anybody who, you know, might call me up and say, hey, you know, I really want to come to your school. I live in, you know, England or Spain or something like that. And I go, look, you know, don't waste your money. Don't waste your money on the plane ticket and the hotel rooms. Just go to our school in the UK, or go to, you know, one of our other locations like Spain or in Greece or Dubai or, you know, Norway or Sweden or you know, Poland, you know, South Africa, because the training that they'll get over there is as good as the training that they'll get here. We're really, really tight on how we train, and it's going to be the same. I have 100% confidence in the crew over there, headed by Andy Ibbett, and our crew over in Australia, headed by Steve Brogy. These guys are totally dedicated professionals, and you know, they teach California Superbike School curriculum, to, you know, as well as I do.
Sweet.
Well, maybe not as well as I do, but they do it really good.
Nice.
They do an excellent job, and we just opened up another branch in. We're opening up another branch in Spain. We have another sub branch in Greece right now, and also New Zealand just started up.
And you even went to the Philippines, right?
We have been to the Philippines and Malaysia, that was out of our Australian branch. Yeah, it's fun to add tracks, and it's fun to add countries, and you know, just keep on pushing the envelope. And for me, it's just a continuous voyage of discovery, trying to figure out how to ride these things.
You know, speaking of which, you know, the electronics. We've got a lot of electronics coming online now. You know, obviously in the prototypes, but also coming to the street bikes. And obviously technology is always going to move forward, and all of this stuff is eventually, you know, we'll be figuring it out. But and you kind of allude to this in the DVD also, is that, you know, a lot of the skills, obviously, it doesn't matter, you know, whether you have ABS and traction control, or you're still using drum brakes or something, but you're still applying the same kind of skills. Yet I think that there's a little bit of a disconnect between rider and bike, like when you've got true fly-by-wire. And you know, how do you teach your guys in your school about that kind of technological advance?
Well, first of all, we don't, except for the pro riders we coach, the use of you know, the full ability to use traction control is still going to be a high level activity. You know, your average track day guy isn't going to go out and just, you know, turn the thing into a corner and pin the throttle and get a good result, because there are just too many other things going on at the same time for it to turn into a very bad result. So again, once again, the basics, the fundamental riding skills and techniques of how you use your eyes, how you use the bike, what do you do on the bike? You know, again, Lorenzo's somehow or another managed to outsmart, you know, $500,000 worth of fantastic electronic controls. So what I think is that, and that's what I think about it, you know, your basics have to be solid before it's going to be of any value whatsoever to anybody.
What I was actually getting at was that it might actually inhibit those basics from being, you know, reachable.
Yeah, I think, you know, riding techniques and styles and so on, they come and go. And things are very stylish for a while, and then they go. I mean, how many guys are really backing the bikes in like they were 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years ago?
Right, that's true.
And the answer is almost nobody is doing it anymore, because even though it's fun, even though it looked cool, even though everybody, I'm sure, liked to watch themselves do it on the, you know, on the TV screens and all that kind of stuff, it turns out it's slow. It's there's a lot of work being done. For no result, in fact, a negative result. So, you know, there's a stylish thing. Thumb rear brakes. Well, they came and went pretty fast, didn't they?
Yeah.
But it was all the rage for a while. There were lots of companies out there making them, and it was like, okay, this is going to be it. This is going to be the thing. You know, well, that's never going to be the thing. The machine is never going to be the thing. You know, I mean, if you could have a huge inequity, and you know, this guy has got a 200 horsepower bike, and this guy's got a 250 horsepower bike. Okay, you're going to have a problem. With riders of equal skill, but it boils down to the pilot. You know, the guy who's sitting in the seat, he's got to be able to do all these things well. He's got to be able to do them well enough so he's consistent with them. And if he can't be, and if he doesn't have enough basic skill, enough fundamental skills under his belt, it's just not going to work out. He's going to have, you know, up again, down again results. And as long as motorcycles have two wheels and handlebars, it's going to remain that way.
Let's hope they do.
Me too. I hope so too, yeah.
That's what makes them so fun.
Exactly. They're dangerous. That's why they're fun.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Yeah, well, it's been great. I want to thank you for having me on the show, Jules. It's been fun. It's great to you know, talk about these things. And, you know, it's great to have outlets like you've got for this type of thing. You know, fortunately I've got a couple. You know, my column in Motorcyclist Magazine gets me to, you know, bend my mind and think about things in a slightly different way than than I normally do for school research, and you know, or working with some pro riders that are already at the top, like Leon Cammier. I mean, we're super proud of him for sure. Or, you know, the other end of the scale, the riders who are fantastic, like Peter Lenz. You know, he's a very good rider.
Yeah.
And some other guys we're working with, you know, are coming along really well. Austin DeHaven is doing an excellent job for the first season on a, you know, totally anemic 600 R6. And Joe Roberts, another 12-year-old guy who's showing some real, real promise and did really well back east in the final races. So it's fun to be able to deal with, you know, guys who come to the school who are 50. It's great to be able to start with somebody like Peter Lenz, you know, at 8 years old and see, you know, them just blossom and bloom like he has, like Joe Roberts has, and now, you know, taking on some other guys. So it's great to work the whole progression of this thing. You know, I mean, it would be great if Valentino Rossi called me up and said, "Hey, you know, I'm struggling a little bit. Could you help me?" And, you know,
in 5 years, you might be getting that call. You know,
I'd at least try. You know, I'd at least try. But you know, maybe I do know something that would help. I don't know. It's hard to tell. To me, I just go agog. You know, I'm a like 100% spectator sometime, and I just watch. You know, totally from the spectator viewpoint. And then sometimes something catches my eye and I start digging, and you know, it might take me 2 or 3 years to figure out why it is and how to fix it and how to drill it and how to coach it. But that's the game I chose 34 years ago, and here I am.
Very cool. Yeah, well, you know, you've been very successful with it, so keep on going.
Thanks a million, Jules. Yeah, we got an incredible season coming up this year. We're changing our major sponsor. We're going to go with BMW this year for the California Superbike School.
Whoa! And with the new bike.
Yep. Yeah, we're going to have a whole fleet of the new S1000RR, and you know, it's a big change because, well, for you know, 30 years we've been with Kawasaki. We've had 600s the whole time, and I got the opportunity to ride the S1000, and I was really, really impressed because, you know what, it didn't feel like a 1000 at all. It felt, you know, light and nimble like a 600. But when you rolled that 193 horsepower on, you know what, it was talking to you. it was definitely talking to you. But the, you know, the power's linear and the bike's super, super neutral. So we're really going to be happy to. This is a big, you know, turning a big new page, new chapter in the California Superbike School history. For a superbike school, and now we got, you know, real superbikes at the school, and it's great because they're tame and they're like pussycats. They're so controllable. It's incredible.
That's very cool. Well, congratulations and good luck with that. That's actually a motorcycle I'm very interested in seeing how it kind of turns the sport bike world on its side a bit, you know, because it's very, very bold.
It's bold and it's an affordable bike too. That's a cool thing. I mean, the Pro just come out with an RS V4, but you know, I think it's a $28,000 motorcycle,
right.
And the new S1000 BMW is, you know, it's like 13.8. So, okay, and you know, it's just a hair under 200 horsepower. But you know, I mean, you can put anybody on. You could put anybody on that bike, and they could ride a motorcycle, and they'd be happy because it's just, you know, that's the whole thing is control.
Wow, that's great. Well, so you're going to be all blue and white and silver, black, whatever that color scheme.
Yeah, we'll be wow. Red, white, blue, wow. Silver, black. You know, we'll be all that. We'll be all BMW this coming year, and it's
that's going to be weird because we're so used to seeing you guys always in green. You know.
Yes. Well, it's been a great long relationship with Kawasaki, and you know. They, like quite a few of the other manufacturers, we see, you know, the race teams have disappeared here in the U.S. for sure. You know,
yeah.
It's kind of got, it's all sort of, everything's drifted a little bit with, or quite a lot actually, with the change in the economic climate. So, you know, I'm hoping for the best for American racing, but I think most of the attention is going to be on the World Superbike and MotoGP, and it's going to take maybe, you know, the States a little while to pull itself back together again. Just because of the economic crunch. So, you know, we're sorry to leave Kawasaki. They treated us really nicely for the last three decades.
All right. Well, cool, man. Thank you so much again, and ciao.
Thank you. We'll see ya.
Bye-bye.
Okay, so thank you so much, Keith, for coming on the show. We had a great time, and hopefully we'll be able to hook up again in the future. And that's pretty much the show. Remember, we've got the please rate the writers for us. So that's 204@motogpod.com.
That would 204@motogpod.com. 204@motogpod.com.
There you go. One more time.
It was kind of like TV. 204@motogpod.com.
Right. P.O. Box something.
Kids, cards and letters, send them in. We're happy to listen. And enjoy that you guys listening to us, and know that we enjoy talking to you. So cheers, and we'll talk to you next week.
Sweet. All right. Ciao. And good night, Jim.
Night, Jules.